Greetings to you, my beautiful children of light. It is I, Dee Trussell. This is the Doug Trussell Family Hour podcast. In today's episode, as one of my favorite guests, not that I like to create some dark, stupid hierarchy of guests on the DTFH, but Robert Ryan is incredible. Not only is he a world-famous tattoo artist, he also is a Shaivite who built his own beautiful temple, and he is one of the most disciplined, spiritual people who I've ever met in my life. Unfortunately, the very beginning of this episode got cut off, which really sucks because we were having this fantastic conversation about squirrel motivations, and because of that, I just want to share with you what we were talking about, even though it has nothing to do with the rest of the podcast. I assign benevolence to the animals in my yard. And this is probably a mistake. I don't assign it to the insects. I don't assign it to the mosquitoes, but for some reason, the squirrels, the rabbits, the deer, the hippos, the Portuguese swans, the limping turtles, they don't really limp, that's just the name of them, they're very rare, the wood-ringed peacocks and the orangutans and the beautiful pony that I just gave to my daughter, as well as the stallions that we keep in the barn and the eagles in the hatchery and the falcons. And I even assigned benevolence to my falcon trainer, Bertrand. But, you know, sometimes the assignment of benevolence backfires on you. And of course, we shouldn't assign human ethics to squirrels. And we can't anymore, thanks to the Supreme Court. Let's go, Brandon. It's illegal now. You'll get arrested. But regardless, I just have always thought the squirrel in my yard was sweet. I don't know why. He looks sweet. I guess they're kind of scary if you think about it, but I mean, if they're a giant, I guess that's any animal. Like, you enlarge a cat 10 times the size of a cat, you know, that's a lion. And they're a mess, except for my lions. I forgot to mention them. They're not a mess. We keep them highly sedated on a cocktail of Xanax and MDMA, which allows my children to literally sleep on them for nap time sometimes. They're adorable, and they are just wonderful when they're drugged. This squirrel, I've just always thought it was like clever and sweet. And the other day, I'm sitting on the back porch with my wife enjoying a 1798 rosé. It was one of the last bottles of its kind on earth. It was given to Ben Franklin by a witch that lived near him. And I saw, climbing up the tree, this wonderful squirrel with a squirming mouse in its mouth. This thing was carrying that thing to eat it. I mean, you can only assume that. I can't imagine they were friends and it was like, God, well, let me show you what it's like up here. Just this poor mouse clutched in the mouth of a squirrel. You know, and squirrels, I don't think they have like poking teeth like most carnivorous animals. Don't they just kind of have like, I don't know, I've never looked at his teeth. You know, he's pretty good at hiding from me, like goes on the other side of the tree, but pretty sure they have like kind of like those old dentures you find in graveyards, broken and jagged, but not sharp enough to kill right away. But I just can't even imagine what that mouse was experiencing as it got carried up into a tree by a squirrel. So that's what we were talking about, and that's what got cut off. But luckily for you, I retold it, and you can see why. It's a very important story. Robert Ryan is incredible. If you're lucky enough to live in Philadelphia and you're looking for a tattoo, he's the man. I have all the links you need to find him at DuncanTrussell.com, but you could just Google his name and see the incredible tattoos that he creates. He also makes beautiful art. If I ever do get a tattoo, Robert Ryan will be the person who puts that needle right above my butt. Because I've always had a dream of just like a wonderful sort of, I'm not going to say tramp stamp. I hate that term. It's insulting. It's like degrading to tramps. And as a tramp, and I've been a tramp for a long time, there's more to us than just having like a tattoo on our butts that you people can ogle over as you use our bodies. There's deeper dimensions to tramps. Trust me. Trust me. I've had my heart broken so many times. So many times. And that's why, you know, I just want, as my, not tramp. I mean, you know what? I'm going to reclaim it. As my tramp stamp, I want it to say, don't leave me, please, right above my butt, so that when I am being ridden in the night by some lusting man, lady, whoever decides to climb on board the heartbreak train, they're going to look down at it and they're going to know what my heart is telling them. Please don't leave me. Please, please stay with me. Just one more night. I'm not the angel of the morning. I need commitment. I need you to love me and hold me, tell me stories at night, bottle feed me, let me suck on your feet and take long urine baths with you. You know, don't just do that thing, you know? Don't do that. Don't throw me away. I might put that somewhere else, right above my penis. Don't throw me away. And on the back, please don't leave me. Anyway, if one day I decide to get those tattoos, Robert Ryan is definitely going to be the person that I choose to do that very important work for me. This is a really great conversation. We covered a lot of ground. You know, like I have a sporadic, embarrassingly sporadic meditation practice. Robert Ryan diligently pursues Eastern mystical traditions in a way that I've only seen in monks at Hare Krishna temples. And I've been lucky enough to be friends with him for a while and to watch the effect that level of discipline has had on his life. He's super cool, and I think that you are really going to enjoy this conversation about mantras, about the ancestors, and about Vedic traditions. It's definitely one of my favorite podcasts in a long time, and I took a lot out of it, and I think you will too. So get ready. Come see me do live stand-up. I'm going to be at Helium, Philadelphia, the 12th, 13th, and 14th of October. I hope you will come out to a show. After that, I'm going to be at the Spokane Comedy Club on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th of November. And I would love it if you would come and see me do stand-up. Also, I've got a Patreon. It's patreon.com/DTFH. You will get commercial-free episodes of this podcast, the opportunity to hang out with me and your beloved DTFH family once a week. I'm trying to get it together, friends. I want to do it once a week, but it's been wild with a new baby in the house. Don't know why I said it like that, but I hope you'll subscribe. It's patreon.com/DTFH. Okay, everybody, get ready. Strap on. Here we go. Let's dive into this conversation with Robert Ryan. You know, one of the ways in, it starts with like a kind of interest that has like a sort of academic quality that has built into it a condescension or something that you might not even be aware of. You know what I mean? Because you're kind of thinking like, well, you know, these, you're not thinking it consciously, but these superstitious fools, you know, they're, you know, LARPing. They've gotten wrapped up in something and it's giving them some
it's mitigating their fear of death. And so, but then, I mean, I'm talking, this is like, I was so cynical. And then, you know, the more you sort of look into it, you want to, like, you think to yourself, I want to experience the mantra. Is it hypnotic? What is it? You start doing these mantras. And then this strange thing starts happening where you'll wake up in the morning and you'll want to look at the Bhagavad Gita or something, you know, and this thing starts growing. And then suddenly it goes from being a kind of academic intellectual pursuit to you begin to realize that there's something here more than just some like hypnotic trance state you're putting yourself into as you connect with these stories. And then that's when it gets really interesting because all this cool stuff starts happening. And do you know what I mean? You're thinking you've gone from the sort of Dawkins style existential examination of the thing to I want that to happen to me again. The out of body experience, the dream about the God, the vision that I had. You know what I mean? And then you're in another sand trap, right? Like you get stuck again. And do you know what I'm talking about? Like as the path progresses. Yeah. So can you talk, like, do you remember when you first became attracted to Eastern mysticism and what your path was from that point to having a temple and a guru and a deep disciplined practice?
Yeah, to really start from where you began with what you just beautifully expressed that I think most people go through I think this is something that everyone experiences in this path in life through a lot of things, because throughout, as we discuss it, you can kind of see how it, all those same things that you just described will manifest in different aspects of your regular life, not your quote unquote spiritual life.
Right.
And you start to, when you do start to practice, you see how those things are in tandem. But yes, so the sadhana that I've been practicing recently and for the last couple of years, but really trying to go deep into it in the last few weeks, is that of meditations on a devi, a goddess called Tripura Sundari. And she is the manifestation of all creative capacity. And like all language, all music, and creative capacity, like having children too.
Yeah,
all creative things that happen on the planet are happening through her.
What's her name?
These meditations. It's Lalita Tripura Sundari.
Okay.
And it's the chanting of the Lalita Sahasranam is the sadhana, which is her 1,000 names. So you're going through all these different aspects of her creative capacity. So anyway, she's holding a noose and a goad. So you know the noose will pull you forward and then the goad will like push you along the path, you know.
Whoa.
it's two of her attributes. So at some point when you start to develop a taste for these kind of things, she's there to pull you in, and if you start going astray, she's able to push you. So she's constantly pushing and pulling you through this path.
Wow.
And she stands in the center of that. She's holding up one with her left, one with her right. So she's equilibrium, you know, she's the balance of those two things. So when you start to chant magical formulas, these mantras to her, that becomes in balance. And then you start to see that manifest in your life. So that's like one of the ways that I think we can look at this as like, okay, is there this goddess that's there with a noose and like a poking thing to like, you know, guide you around? It's not too much different than the devil on your shoulder, you know,
right?
You know, or it's not. Oh, I think that's a westernized aspect of it. The pushing, it's pushing and pulling constantly.
It's a noose, like a strangling noose, like the what you hang people.
No, it's a noose, like you would guide, you know, like the it's the Ankush and the Pasu. It's for elephants. One okay. you would pull the elephant with, and the other you would push. Okay. That's what the goad is.
Got it.
But for her, it and then Pashupati, which is like is the Gosu's of all the beasts that are led, you know. Pashupati is a name for Shiva. And so he's the leader of anything that is led through that noose that she is guiding us with.
What a great way to symbolize the creative process. Like, because sometimes you feel like it's pulling you, which is the best, you know, when you're being drawn into it. And then sometimes you're nothing's pulling you at all.
Yeah, or and you're being pushed away, you know, you're being like, yeah, I leave this alone for a while, you know, or yeah. You're not going in the right direction, you know?
Yeah.
And so when you start chanting these mantras, you start to develop that dialogue with the true self that you are, that you should follow some of those instincts, or you should investigate those instincts, or you should look at them and observe them. You know, you don't necessarily always have to act upon them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that is like, you know, when it comes to making stuff, that's so frustrating because you know, it's in the West, especially, you know, grind culture, you have this idea of like, I need to keep hacking away at this thing no matter what. Like, and it's hard to trust the stepping away from it part. It's, you think you're worried you're going to give up.
Yeah. Like you said, that part, there's always that part of you is like, why am I doing this? You know, what does this even mean? You know, and those are the thoughts, you know, that's your mind producing thoughts. And like if you start to go down that path, it will just accumulate at a breakneck speed. And all of a sudden you have anything you can possibly do to keep you between you and what you truly want to achieve.
Right. Now, what's one of these mantras? What do they sound like?
Do you have one memorized? Are you allowed to say
it? No, I wouldn't say it just because I'm not qualified to give it to anybody else.
Oh, okay.
But
right. That's another interesting thing about mantras. Some of them, you can't find them. They're transmitted from guru to student, which is really interesting, like little passwords or something that you only get when you're ready for them.
Yeah, well, they know the effect that it can have, and like it's a responsibility to the mantra that these gurus keep to, you know, in order to not dilute them or have them wind up in the wrong hands, or, you know, they know the power of them, and that's why they're treated with such delicacy. But yeah, so what I'm doing, though, I can say is that I'm chanting her 1,000 names.
Wow. You know?
And there's so much revealed in those 1,000 names. I'm just on the surface of them, you know, because my English to Sanskrit isn't that great at all. So, you know, and I do have an English interpretation, but I'm really just trying to work through the pronunciation at this point.
What would happen if you translated the names to English and said them in English? Would they still have the same resonance?
Yeah, probably even better, you know, because what a mantra is doing is it's instilling something. It's establishing something in you, you know, and it's establishing, it's got the ability to change your point of view. And that's truly what magic is, you know.
Right.
A magician, it has the ability to
you know, change your point of view and lead you in a different way. So yeah, these mantras, like, I don't know where I was going with that, but they are magical formulas, you know?
Right. Yeah. You know, and this is something that maybe you don't, that many people don't know.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
In English, what it's doing is you're telling yourself something, you know, that this goddess lives inside of me. This God lives inside of me. I have these strengths. I can overcome this through the help of this God, you know? So it's like going to the gym, right, psychically, you know?
Right. It's kind of like, you know, shining a light or something on a specific form that it could get lost within all the other stuff going on inside of you, right? So you're sort of like recognizing via the mantra, this is what this thing is. It's solidifying, crystallizing, or like going from background to foreground, right? There's so many other things going on.
That we live a life beyond just our gross material body, you know? Beyond that body, there's a subtle body and there's a causal body. So, you know, it's the in between, and then also the consciousness, you know? Right. So, you know, when you're starting to wake those things up in yourself, you know, you might be able to navigate through those three worlds that we have to live in, you know, every moment of our life.
Now, some mantras are just in the public domain. Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, yes. Ram, Ram, Ram. Like these are all there for anybody. And this is, I think, some people don't know that, like, when you set off on one of these paths, if you're lucky enough to find a teacher, a guru, they recognize in you sort of, like, I guess you could say, manifestations of progress. And they know when you're ready, okay, here's the next thing. Because they don't want to give it to you before you're ready, because it will be confusing, potentially, you know, dangerous in some way. And so that's part of their job, if you want to call it that, is like knowing when the student's ready for the next step. And I think in most books that you find, like, you know, at least at the bookstore, it's always the first step. You know, those books give you, here's the entry level stuff. It doesn't have within it the next thing, which is kind of an exciting thing when you're working with someone and they give you something and they tell you, this is between you and me. This is not for public consumption, which is a really cool moment.
Yeah, it makes it very esoteric, but also it really is like trying to teach algebra before you teach addition and subtraction.
Right.
You know, and when you start to learn, when you start to go deeper into a lot of these practices, there's a ladder being built for you, you know, spiritually, and what you can take. And also, you know, like, you're not going to learn these like long form mantras if you can't even do a one syllable mantra daily, right. You know? So you have to build up that thing. So yeah, a lot of it's completely just practical and completely scientific in the way it's taught, because it's very precise, and that it kind of operates on precision. The manifest is very, you know, the engine is like very nuanced, and if one thing's out of balance, the whole thing doesn't work.
That's
so
right.
That's why they teach it in that way, you know?
But you know, I think, you know, this is another interesting aspect of this stuff, is that at least for me, you think you understand it or know it just going into it, because you've listened to some audibles or you've read some books or you've seen some documentaries, yeah. And not understanding that what you're seeing is the driveway. You're not even in the like past the front gate yet. This is the driveway in, and you look at that, and people look at those things and draw opinions based on that, not realizing that most people don't even know what it actually is. Most people don't even know. They only know the most shallow end of the pool, which is, you know, really interesting to me. You know, and I'm like looking at like my thoughts on Buddhism now versus my thoughts on Buddhism like back when I was in college, it's two different. It's the same, you know, basic RGB fundamental principles, but there's so much more that there's no fucking way anyone could have talked to me about it, because I wouldn't have understood it at all. I would have just heard blah, 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 blah. It wouldn't have made any sense at all. There's no way to get there but through some kind of practice. There's no way.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a whole life of just destroying your preconceived notion of what you thought a practice might be.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look at it as a something that's happening in many lives, which a lot of these Eastern practices are kind of, that's the fundamental principle of it, that, you know, this is like a, you know, this is your entire existence that you're experiencing now. And you're not going to stop experiencing it when you die. So
yeah, right.
If you look at it like that, you know, you have a whole lifetime just to even like kind of rid yourself of anything that's been holding you back this lifetime. So hopefully the next lifetime, you'll be in a better, you know, better position to continue on the journey. You have a whole lifetime just to even like kind of rid yourself of anything that's been holding you back this lifetime. So hopefully the next lifetime, you'll be in a better, you know, better position to continue on the journey.
Right.
So, yeah.
I love, that's the other thing is, you know, I was having a conversation with some friends the other night and they're like, so you believe in reincarnation? And, you know, there was a time when I wouldn't know how to answer that, but now it's like, yeah, yes, I do. Absolutely. And because that perspective, even though, you know, in Buddhism, the emphasis is more on this nowness of things. Like if we get too caught up in past lives or future lives or whatever, then you miss this life, which is the one you're experiencing. So worry about this one now, you know, with an emphasis on, because you're going to die. And when you die, you want to have some, you want to be prepped for what that's going to be like when you don't have a body anymore, so that you can, you know, maybe make a smarter decision. You don't want to do for your next life what you do when you get out of a shitty relationship and like, you know what I mean? Immediately like jump into another relationship because you're lonely, which I think is like the pattern that happens when people die, is they are so eager to get a body that they just dive right back in at people are doing rebound lives. You know, yeah. What I mean? You know what I mean? They're doing rebound lives. It's like, dude, you gotta like.
It's truth. It's 100% truth. It's funny, you know, like the reincarnation thing, what else in nature just ends, you know? And I mean, everything changes. It's constantly changing. Where there was a building, there's now a tree. Where there was a tree, there's now a building, you know? Yeah. Every season we watch the plants produce life and die, you know? But it continues. And we're part of that continuum. The continuum, it is a continuum. It doesn't end. You know, so this experience we're having in this body, in this, what we think is this life, it continues no matter what. Even if it's a completely different point of view, it's going to continue. Energy cannot be created or destroyed.
Right. You know? Well, from the, you know, the hyper materialist perspective, it's like, okay, sure. Like atomically, we continue. But, you know, the argument against reincarnation, I think there's like a lot of great arguments against it, primarily prove it. You can't, I mean, and I'm sure there's all the kids who like remember their past lives and, but also I think that with reincarnation. People get confused about people like us when we say we believe in it, because their perspective is we're, again, trying to come up with some metaphysical balm to soothe the existential horror, which is the materialist's day-to-day reality, which is like you're a fucking mistake, basically. I mean, you're the universe burped out your meaty sentient ass. You don't have enough time to figure out what the fuck's going on here, and then you die in some painful, awful way, with there being no meaning and pure absurdity in your life. And you know, so they think, because that's what they believe, that people like us, it's like, okay, idiots, does that make you feel better? Does a tooth fairy come and carry your soul into fantasy land and give you a new body? And whereas from like, at least the Buddhist perspective, it's like, we don't want that to keep happening. Like, trying to like, we recognize the fundamental suffering of this situation. And the idea is to like relinquish our attachment to always having to be in a goddamn body. And to get to spin on that, to keep getting on same fucking carousel, like some idiot at a fair, some dummy who's like, oh, this time I'm gonna ride the unicorn, and then I'll do the penguin, and then I'll do the dragon, and then I'll do the chariot, and then I'll do the horse, and then I'll, you know, on and on and on. It's like, it's dizzying. You it's the same damn fucking loop. It's just different things you're sitting on. In this case, the different things are your body. It's not, you know, I think that's an important note, is it's like, this isn't like necessarily some way out of the reality, the finality of death. It's just pointing out that many people who think they're so logical and rational in their belief that upon the dropping of the body, there's pure, absolute, blissful, infinite nothingness. That's heaven. It's like, that's, you believe in heaven. That's just as ridiculous as, then you go up there, there's a gate and a dude with a pin, and you go and it's Golden Roads. Everybody gets a mansion. And you know what I mean? It's just a different form of the same wishful thinking. Instant mitigation of infinite lifetimes of karmic reactivity via the absolution of oblivion, or some like getting a great like high rise condo in heaven. It's, you know what I mean, like both of these things are bombs.
They're not mutually exclusive, though. You know, it's like we're if we learn to live happy and content and peaceful, that if we are forced to take our next life again or 10 more, we can approach it with like, okay, here's another one. Let's do it again. Let's do the dance again. You know, it's really truly mastery. You know, it's when you master that, you know, where like you limit your needs, you make a very small sandwich for the god of death. You know, you don't want to be a huge feast when Mahakala is chewing you up at the end of your life. You don't want to have a ton of regrets, and you don't want to have to struggle through this process. You go happily knowing that, hey, maybe there's another chance. Maybe I'll have, you know, like maybe I'll live in a whole another amazing, magical experience like this one. You know,
yes.
It's like when we get so like, oh, you know, like I know. Yeah, I want to get off this wheel. It's fucking hard, man. Every single day, nothing is easy. Nothing, you know, nothing happens without tons of effort, even more so now than ever. But it still is a magical, beautiful, wonderful place. And we still have the ability to live amazing lives.
Oh, my God.
I see it all as such a gift, you know. And even the suffering can be a gift.
Well, absolutely. I mean, as a parent, it's like, absolutely, it's the greatest suffering you can have, and at least from my perspective. And also, I think it's important to note that built into these ideas is the notion that it's only the carousel, that you're only riding on the carousel. But another aspect of these practices is they reveal to you, you're alive and dead simultaneously. Like the oblivion you're so worried about, that's you too. You're there. You're in it. The void, the anesthesia that saves you from the pain of death. One of my favorite Richard Dawkins quotes. It's already happening to you. So you, it's like you think you're not dying and you think you're not dead now. Bad news. Bad news for you, friend. You're as dead as you've ever been and as you always will be, in the sense that the carousel's half the thing. For the carousel to spin, it's got to have space around it, and it's not going to spin anymore. It's got to have this neutral, empty space for the building to go where the tree was, the tree to go where the building was. There has to be
inertia.
Yes. Yeah. So it's happening now. And to me, that's the relief that you get. That's the where you realize, oh, right. Like the thing I'm afraid of, I already am. I'm already this emptiness. It's already here now.
We're part of it. You know, we are it. We're experiencing it. It's of us. And like right now, this time of year is right before we celebrate two called Navaratris, one in the spring, one in the fall. And it's the awakening of consciousness and it's the putting to sleep of consciousness. You know, it's like when the crops die. And right before it, we worship the ancestors for a number of days. And the meditation is going back to seven generations of your ancestors. So you're meditating on your grandfather's 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 grandfather, you know, stuff like that.
Wow.
And as you're doing it, man, you're really starting to come into view on what part of this track you've been through this whole, you know, and how if they took what you're doing is you're taking on their debts. That's one of the mantras is like, you know, I'm here to absolve you of any karmic debt you've built up over this time, any things that went unanswered, you know, any loose ends. I'm here to tie those up for seven generations. But like, and the idea is like, if one of those relatives took a different turn, your life would not be the life it is right now.
That
so you're paying
so
homage
awesome.
To that.
God, you know, I
and
love that.
It's a really beautiful, like I never met, I think my great grandmother was the oldest that went on, and that was just one of four, you know, the four of them, you know.
That is so beautiful. It's so counter the way people, the Western people, like they're so pissed at their parents. They're so fucking pissed at their parents. And the idea of taking on the debt of your abusive alcoholic relative or whoever abused your parents to make them abuse you or whoever abused your parents' parents to, it's so beautiful because in there is some kind of forgiveness. It's like, okay, I'm not only going to like work on my own shit here. I'm going to do everything I can to alleviate you of all the bad decisions you made that made your life full of suffering and made our relationship messed up. And there is a real, that's beautiful, man. That's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. That's incredible.
It's a 5,000-year-old magical formula for the prescription of seven generations of familiar abuse and trauma.
Robert, you know what I love that's built into all of these traditions? What you just talked about, it shifts the me-centered attitude to how can I help instead of how do I help myself, which when you're pissed at your parents and many times rightfully pissed at your fucking parents, there's a lot of like self-centeredness in it. You know what I mean? You're not thinking about them at all because you're angry at them. The last thing you're thinking is, how do I help them? Fuck them. They abused me. Fuck them. They confused me. Fuck them. They were narcissists. Why do I have to give a fuck about them? All this anger. And right, I get it. But the moment you shift your thinking into, okay. I'm going to help them. I'm going to try to purify the mistakes they made because I am now paying for them anyway. You know, like if you've got trauma from your parents, you're paying for those debts, whether you like it or not. That is the experience of paying your parents' debts, is every day waking up sort of depressed, miserable, disconnected. Your relationships are fucked up. You had a bad model. So it's like shifting that into, okay, they were imperfect. Now I am imperfect. They're, and going back that far, you know what I mean? It's just, it suddenly it just shifts that heavy sludge-like feeling that comes from being victimized to a hero's attitude. Now you're the fucking hero because the hero saves everybody. You know, the so, hero does what the hero can do to save as much as possible.
The last line in that meditation for the ancestors is, you are the link in the healing.
Wow. Wow.
So it's powerful. It's powerful to think about. And you have to come to a place where you love yourself before you're able to forgive all the things that have happened, you know? And that's what you're constantly working on, you know? But like you said, why suffer through all those things that you've had to already suffer through,
right?
You know, to get to where you are, where you can live beyond it. You know, you always can. And if you have to strive for it tenaciously, then that's the work that needs to be done. Some people get it a lot easier, you know, but
yeah, well,
everybody deals with it. Yeah. And, but even, you know, like children and parents, the relationship between them, it's a very complicated, weird thing, you know? So no one's a stranger to those problems. You know, they're just amplified on different levels and different frequencies, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and you might not have like Bukowski's childhood where his dad was just beating him with a belt and drunk and burning him. You might just have like a parent who didn't know how to say, I love you, or I'm sorry, or, you know, basic shit like that. Yeah. But it's still, you know, it's still the same pattern. Just it's the same math, just, you know, a little less extreme.
Yeah. And then, you know, like we were talking about earlier, the only way to break that pattern is to repay pay the debt, just to like not continue it and move on and let people know that you can become a being of love out of the most severely hateful situation.
Absolutely. And because, you know, it's like, it's an interesting thing when by rejecting something, you become the thing you're rejecting via the rejection. You know what I mean? Like if you look at most miserable people, part of their misery is they have a vengeance plan, right? And they're part of the vengeance. One of the ways they get revenge is some form of rejection of the perceived attacker. I'm punishing you by rejecting you. And I'm doing that because it's the right thing to do to teach you a lesson. And they don't realize that they've embodied the aggressive thing via the rejection, that now they're mirroring. There's no transformation at all. It's just, you're repeating it in a different way. And this stuff is like helping you get out of that awful trap. I'm listening to this great audiobook on Buddhism, and they talk about the near enemy of things and the far enemy of things. The near enemy is where you don't realize that you have brought into your reality something that is destructive. And the way that it becomes the near enemy is that you have gotten confused and you think the destructive is actually constructive. You know what I mean? So it's the most confusing because you don't even see it's destructive. That's the near enemy. The far enemy is like the obvious stuff that is easy to see. That's fucked up. I'm not going to do that. That's bad. Or the near enemies are the ones that get us. And my God, talk about near enemies. That's your goddamn family.
Yeah. The nearest, the closest, the ones that know you the best are the most dangerous, you know?
Yeah. When do you do that practice? When does that start up?
I've started it. It's been in about 5 days, and it goes to Navaratri, which is the end of, or it's another like 10 days. So it'll be about 14 days of doing it.
Wow. You mean you've been doing the creativity one? What about the family?
Oh, the creativity one is 48 days, which is usually, I think we might have talked about this once before. They're called sankalpas. So sankalpa means a determination. So you make a determination that you're going to do this mantra for this long. So this one I'm doing is for 48 days. And then the ancestors one is 14 days within that. It just starts before it.
Gotcha. Okay. Another question that I have for you. I just read this. I don't know. I had no idea that in Japan, if you have tattoos, you're a fucking outcast. You can't go to the spas. You can't go here. You can't go there. They don't like tattoos. No, I had no idea. So I was wondering, is there, like, does that show up, like, with your guru and you and what you do, putting this beautiful art on people's bodies? Is this considered haram?
No, not at all. Actually, there's a mystical tattooing that exists in the tantras. You know, it's a tattooing of the body and mystical symbols. A lot of folk cultures in India practice tattooing, and that's kind of in tandem with a lot of their spiritual beliefs.
Okay.
In Japan, I know about this because I'm a tattoo artist. For those anyone listening that doesn't know that, that's what I do for a living. I know a little bit of the history. It's because it's associated with organized crime. With the Yakuza. That's why. And the thing is, the country, the politically can't like get behind it, but underground is the coolest thing ever, you know. Okay. And there's bathhouses for people with tattoos, you know, and the Yakuza bathhouses, you know, the Japanese mafia bathhouse is going to be like probably the coolest, most insane bathhouse you're ever going to go to, you know. Like,
no, it's not. I want to fuck up the Yakuza bathhouse because there's probably some shit I won't do, a way you pull your towel. Next thing you know, you're in the trunk of a car.
What I'm saying, though, is that the Japanese tattoo culture has informed the entire world of aesthetically, out of principle. There's a whole art, there's a whole canon of design that goes along with it, and it's in step with the Japanese woodcutting art. So, you know, like, all, you know, it's just a rich history that has only been in the last maybe 100 years where it's become like, you know, that's it. They just associate it with organized crime, and then it carries a stigma hard there.
Okay, know? Now it but, makes sense.
Yeah, but yeah. So there's always, you know, in the United States, it's been banned in certain cities over time. You know, it's always kind of the wrong side of the tracks, kind of seedy underworld. But obviously now it's popular. There's 10 TV shows about it, and it's. Right now, a slow time for the business just because everything's slowing down. But it's one of the more popular ways of commercial art currently. You know, most artists I know who make a living commercially are tattoo artists, you know, like visual artists, I mean.
Okay, we have a few minutes left. I'm sorry to even ask this, but, you know, I've had this fantasy of you giving me a tattoo forever. Yes. And something got in the way of that fantasy. I saw a picture of lymph nodes that had tattoo ink in them.
Yeah.
That happens?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Jesus Christ!
It wouldn't happen to you from one tattoo. It happens to people that have, like, three layers of tattoos. And like using like, you know, it's a heavily regulated industry, but there's still people just putting, you know, you can buy shit on fucking Amazon tattoo machine and tattoo ink. You don't know what's in it and just tattoo people, you know, and that happens all the time. So
that's crazy.
If it's done properly and you have one tattoo, I think you'll be safe.
Yeah. Also, I'm an old man who gives a fuck, right? I don't have that much longer anyway.
I say it all the time. You might not need a tattoo. Like, you know, people, a lot of times people say, oh, I don't have any or whatever. And, you know, if you haven't gotten one yet, maybe you just didn't need one.
I have one.
You know, it's not a requirement.
I have a tattoo. I have a dot in my solar plexus that they put for the radiation machine to blast one of my lymph nodes. I already have a tattoo. And that's always been, I've been like, oh, we got to finish this tattoo. Like, they just put one dot, you know, we got to expand that thing a little bit. It's like dumbest tattoo. It's like a tattoo you get at a slumber party with a pin, which my idiot friends would do and jam the fucking pin into your skin.
Well, it's a survivor's tattoo. So I think it's probably one of the coolest ones, you know.
It is a survivor's tattoo, but like, I don't know. We could talk about it, man. Are you coming out to Philadelphia, to Helium?
I would love to.
Great.
Yeah, I got some stuff going on the night before, but I think I'm going to make it. If
I'm there the whole weekend, so any day.
All right, awesome.
Great.
Yeah, man. I want to come.
And folks listening who want to visit your shop, how booked are you right now? Is it tough to get in there?
No, it's real easy right now. I was saying a little bit earlier, it's our slower time of year. So you can come to Asbury Park, Electric Tattoo, and come get a tattoo from me.
Come get a tattoo and get some of the greatest conversation you've ever had in your life while you're getting the tattoo by someone who's chanting a variety of secret mantras when they're not giving tattoos, AKA the coolest person ever. It is so great catching up with you, man. I love you, and I'm so happy we're friends. Thank you for doing the show.
Oh, man, it's always a pleasure, and thank you so much for having me, and we'll talk soon. I'll see you in Philadelphia.
See you in Philadelphia.
Awesome.
Bye. All the links you need to find Robert are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. What's your website, RobertRyan.com?
I don't even think I have a website at this point.
You're not too cheap.
Instagram is probably the best way to find me.
Okay.
The shop has a website, electrictattoonj.com.
Okay, great. Beautiful. Yeah. All right. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
That was Robert Ryan, everybody. All the links you need to find him will be at duncantrussell.com. If you do get a tattoo from Robert Ryan, I want you to send me a picture of it. He's an incredible artist, and if you're lucky enough to have him put some art onto you, I want to see it. Thank you to our sponsors. And as always, a big thank you to you for listening. I'll see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.